Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we return now to the multiple threads of breaking news in the last day about the Russia investigation. Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani telling the Associated Press and the New York Times that Paul Manafort's lawyers have been briefing Donald Trump's lawyers on what Manafort told investigators during his plea agreement with special counsel Robert Mueller. That's highly unusual, that kind of sharing, and experts say ethically questionable and possibly illegal. Also, conspiracy theorist Jerome Corsi of Birther Theory fame admitting that he told Trump associate Roger Stone in advance in 2016 that John Podesta's emails were going to be released by WikiLeaks in October to damage the Clinton campaign, which they then were. How did he know and who else knew? And the story from The Guardian that quotes unnamed sources saying Manafort met with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in March of 2016, just as Manafort was coming on as Trump's campaign chairman. It was, of course, WikiLeaks that a few months later released those Podesta emails. Those are tantalizing pieces of evidence pointing to, though not proving, collusion. But with us now is Seth Abramson, lawyer, investigative journalist, and University of New Hampshire professor, who has a brand new book called Proof of Collusion. We will see how what has come out in the last 24 hours dovetails with Seth Abramson's 400 pages of meticulously connecting the dots. Seth, thanks for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
First on the news, as a former criminal defense attorney and criminal investigator, what do you make of Manafort's legal team sharing with Trump's legal team things pertaining to Trump that came out of Manafort's cooperation agreement with Robert Mueller?
Well, I would say that it is both, as you pointed out, unethical and potentially illegal. I would suggest that it does suggest an act of obstruction on the part of the president to try to both dangle a pardon in front of Paul Manafort, which he's done repeatedly since Manafort was indicted, and also to get information about what Manafort is telling prosecutors after his plea. But from the standpoint of the attorneys themselves, I do think that it is unethical once you're client has signed a plea to continue a joint defense agreement with someone with whom your client no longer has the same legal interests. Once Paul Manafort pled, his legal interests diverted from those of President Trump's, and therefore his attorneys and frankly President Trump's attorneys should have assumed that there could be no joint defense agreement thereafter, let alone the level of cooperation and communication that we now discover there was.
Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani is the one who disclosed this himself to the public. Do you think this is Rudy's worst gaffe ever and he's made a number, or is he up to something?
Well, I think that what Rudy has said, and he's correct in this much, is that ultimately, at least for Donald Trump, this is a political question, the Mueller investigation, rather than at this point a legal question, because he can't be indicted and tried while he's a sitting president. So what Rudy is doing is he's playing a political game. I think every statement that he makes to the press sounds, to be honest, both unprofessional and surprisingly ahistorical to anyone who has practiced criminal law. And if you're looking at his comments from a legal standpoint, that's going to be one's reaction as a legal professional. However, if one realizes that what Rudy is doing is playing a political game, he's playing to Trump's political base, he's speaking to the Republicans in the Senate who would have to vote to convict Donald Trump after an impeachment in the House, then I think his statements make sense. He's playing off the fact, frankly, that most people don't understand the criminal justice system.
Your book has 100 pages of footnotes at the end, but no index. So I have to ask you, without knowing the answer, does Jerome Corsi show up in your book? Does his communication with Roger Stone in advance, saying he knew WikiLeaks would release John Podesta emails, connect with any dots that you connect in the book?
So I should say that the index is actually available freely online from my publisher, Simon & Schuster, on the website for the book. So people can check out the full index there. But what I will say is that while Randy Credico, who is a mutual friend of Jerome Corsi and Roger Stone, and of course Roger Stone feature prominently in Proof of Collusion, Jerome Corsi as a sort of fringe figure and conspiracy theorist is not someone who features prominently in Proof of Collusion, While there is, however, I should say, a lot of discussion in the book, and really even a timeline in the book, of what happened to Roger Stone after he was allegedly fired by the Trump campaign in August 2015. I say allegedly because of the volume of contacts he continued to have with Donald Trump, trying to litigate with the Trump campaign to bring Paul Manafort on as campaign manager, his own contacts then with WikiLeaks, his public statements about Randy Credico being an intermediary, and then him saying that Randy Credico was not an intermediary to WikiLeaks. But I will say that Jerome Corsi featuring as prominently as he has over the last few days is definitely a recent and new development.
And the Guardian story about Manafort having a three-year relationship with Julian Assange of WikiLeaks leading up to March of 2016 when he took over as Trump campaign chairman. No other news organization has verified that unnamed source story, but news to you, important to you?
Well, I think that the report is news to everyone. Luke Harding, who wrote that report for The Guardian, is one of the experts on Trump-Russia collusion. He wrote a book on that subject a few years ago that I do recommend people check out, as well as Proof of Collusion. But I think that that was actually a bombshell report, Brian, because of the fact that Roger Stone, beginning in August 2015 and going through March 2016, was lobbying Donald Trump directly to hire Paul Manafort. Of course, Roger Stone, a longtime friend and business associate of Paul Manafort. By late February of 2016, both Roger Stone and Trump friend Thomas Barrick had gotten Manafort's letter to Donald Trump introducing himself and asking for a job. Now, sometime after that, in March 2016, two things happened. Number one, Roger Stone has a phone call with Donald Trump convincing him to hire Manafort. And number two, if Luke Harding's report in The Guardian is correct, Paul Manafort meets with Julian Assange. That's important because at the end of that month, March 31st, and hopefully your listeners can follow, I realize there are a lot of dates here. At the end of that month, March 2016, Donald Trump orders his national security team at a meeting at the Trump International Hotel in D.C. to change the RNC platform in July in a way that significantly benefits the Kremlin. That change did take place in July, and Paul Manafort's associate, Konstantin Kilimnik, a Kremlin agent, took credit for the change having occurred. So you have in that string of events a suggestion of a direct quid pro quo. Information from WikiLeaks anticipated to be leaked by Julian Assange in July, with Trump reacting once he learns the news, presumably from either Stone or Manafort in March 2016, by ordering a change to the RNC platform.
I think this is one of the things at the heart of your book, that the public record, you say, already indicates a quid pro quo between Trump and the Kremlin. And you're one of the few people who goes that far. So tell us more about that quid pro quo as you see it in the public record.
Well, the relationship between Donald Trump and highly placed Kremlin-associated Russian oligarchs goes back decades. Donald Trump has benefited to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, even we would say billions of dollars, from his relationships with Russian oligarchs who are attached to the Kremlin. In 2013, he made a trip to Moscow as part of the 2013 Miss Universe pageant, and at that point signed a letter of intent to build a Trump Tower Moscow with Vladimir Putin's top real estate developer. He then announced his presidential run in 2015 in June, and thereafter he signed another letter of intent to build another Trump Tower Moscow with a Russian oligarch by the name of Andrei Rozov. So while he was running for president, Donald Trump was currently in a business relationship with two Russian oligarchs connected to Putin and was developing, or I should say had already developed, his historically pro-Russia policy, which was going to result in trillions of dollars for the Russians in new oil revenues and no benefit to the United States while he was in those negotiations and, in fact, that business relationship with the Russians. What we will see come out of this is a large number of criminal offenses, not merely a single charge of conspiracy, but there's a whole litany of charges that could come from that sort of fact pattern.
We have to take a break, but we'll continue to dive deep on this with Seth Abramson, a former criminal defense attorney, journalist, University of New Hampshire professor, author now of Proof of Collusion, How Trump Betrayed America. And we can take a few phone calls for him in our remaining time at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on on WNYC with Seth Abramson, author of Proof of Collusion, How Trump Betrayed America, which happens to come out on a week where there's a lot of new evidence of collusion, if not quite proof, in a lot of other people's eyes. And Seth, you write interestingly in the book about the infamous Trump Tower meeting in June 2016 between Manafort, Kushner, Trump Jr., and several Russians who had offered Trump Jr. Dirt on Hillary Clinton. Something new about that to most people is about another person who was at that meeting, who you who you write about, named Renat Akhmetshin. Who was he and why does he matter?
Well, he's significant because he's a former Soviet intelligence officer, and I would say somewhat conveniently, the one person who Donald Trump Jr., when he spoke to Congress, was unable to remember even being present. I think that often when we talk about that June 6th, 2016 meeting, people focus on Natalia Veselnitskaya, a Kremlin-associated attorney who was pitching to the Trump campaign, as frankly the Trump campaign was seeking at that time and for many months thereafter, dirt on Hillary Clinton that could be used in the election and that Donald Trump himself would have significant in-kind value if it was received from the Russians or from anyone else. But in fact, we have to acknowledge that there also was a former, possibly current, many people will say you never become a former Soviet intelligence officer, present at that meeting. And I think that we find that same pattern in many of the meetings that occur. And I think there is so much focus on June 6, 2016 that we forget many other critical dates. For instance, that March 31st, 2016 meeting at the Trump International Hotel in D.C. and August 3rd, 2016 meeting between Donald Trump Jr., Eric Prince, and representatives from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and the Russians and the Israelis, at which collusive assistance was offered to Donald Trump Jr. And according to the New York Times in spring 2018, Donald Trump Jr. said yes to that offer on August 3rd, 2016. So there are many dates we need to focus on here, and June 2016 is certainly one of them.
Perry in Long Beach, you're on WNYC with Seth Abramson. Hi, Perry.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I have just a quick question. It's always on my mind. What would be the benefit to the investigators and the American public to be able to see Donald Trump's tax returns?
Are tax returns, Trump's tax returns, in your book, are they related to proof of collusion?
They're absolutely related to proof of collusion. We don't actually have, the public does not have, neither journalists nor anyone in the public, copies of Donald Trump's tax returns. I think Rachel Maddow released one or two pages of past tax returns. But absolutely, they're critical to any forensic investigation in a case of this sort, which is effectively a bribery, wire and bank fraud, conspiracy to defraud the United States, money laundering case. We should assume that is one of the very first things that Robert Mueller would have gotten access to in May of 2017 when he was assigned as the new special counsel. So yes, it's evidence that's critical in a case like this where we're looking at large amounts of money moving between shell corporations, moving almost certainly in a fashion consistent with a money laundering charge or series of charges. And I think I would say to your caller, that's the very reason why Donald Trump never released his tax returns. He knows the value that they can have to federal investigators.
James and Chelsea are on WNYC. Hi, James.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I've been trying for three times to suggest that they look into the communication that happened between the ambassador of Russia that left the day that Donald Trump met him at the White House, and he had all the journalists leave except the photographer and the ambassador. That would be, if there's a tape available still at the White House, that can be a very good telling, because at that time he had the freedom to speak and say anything to the ambassador. And that can be very helpful.
And I believe that was the time just after the firing of James Comey, when Trump reportedly said to the Russian ambassador after everybody else left the room that they'd be a little freer of this whole Russia thing. You familiar with that moment, Seth?
Absolutely. And it is discussed in the book. It's one of the most stunning moments in this entire investigation, though, frankly, there have been dozens of stunning moments. We have to remember at all times when we talk about the Trump-Russia case that everything that occurred in this timeline occurred during a period of time when Donald Trump and, frankly, the rest of the country knew that the Russians had waged cyber war on us during our 2016 presidential election. Donald Trump had that knowledge at the very latest as of August 17th. 2016 when he got his first classified briefing as a presidential candidate. Though, of course, there's evidence that he had information that the Russians had committed cyber crimes against the United States as early as March of 2016. So this, of course, is much, much later. After he's become president, he meets with Sergei Lavrov and Sergei Kislyak in the White House, in the Oval Office, and talks about the firing of Comey, who at that time was investigating him for collusion. That is an incident in American political history that I think very few Americans will forget for a very, very long time.
Back to the Trump Tower meeting for a second. Congressman Adam Schiff, the Democrat who's going to be the chairman of the Intelligence Committee now, told USA Today yesterday that the clearest example of obstruction is phone records that would show whether the blocked phone number logged as Trump Jr. was arranging the meeting with the Russian lawyer in Trump Tower belonged to Donald Trump Sr., that he wouldn't disclose to Congress, Trump Jr., when he was interviewed in committee, who this blocked number was. And I guess it's significant because if he was calling his father, then his father knew something in advance about this meeting that he said he didn't know anything about. How significant is that?
It's quite significant, and it is talked about in the book. The original answer that Donald Trump Jr. gave was that he didn't know who had called from that block number. I should say who he had called at that block number and had received a call from. He did, however, speak twice to Congress, and he ultimately amended his response to saying that it was possible that that was his father. But what I would say as a former criminal investigator is most striking about his testimony to Congress, which I think anyone looking at from a legal professional standpoint would say was dishonest in a number of particulars, is when Donald Trump said that he receives calls from his father every single day, and yet he said to Congress, under the penalty of being charged with a crime for lying, that he had no idea if when his father called him, it showed up as a blocked number on his cell phone. I think any American who receives a call from a family member daily would find it absolutely impossible that Donald Trump would say to Congress and be telling the truth that he didn't know whether his father had a blocked number.
So in our last 20 seconds, and sorry it's that short, do you think anything came of that meeting? Because their line is, yeah, we met with all these Russians. They offered dirt on Hillary Clinton. They asked for relief from sanctions, but then nothing ever came of it. No real dirt on Hillary Clinton.
I think that one of the meetings I mentioned we need to focus on, August 3rd, 2016, is one of the products of the June 2016 meeting. Collusive assistance was offered to Donald Trump Jr., who'd been at that earlier meeting, by the Saudis, the Emiratis, Israeli representatives, and Russian representatives. And I think that was an outcome of that June 2016 meeting. There needs to be more focus on that August 3rd, 2016 meeting at Trump Tower.
Seth Abramson's new book is Proof of Collusion, How Trump Betrayed America. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.